Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 282. It's Monday, December 16th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's get going. Some opinions, polling on American healthcare. This from Gallup News, or Gallup Polling. View of U.S. healthcare quality declines to 24-year low. Americans' positive rating of the quality of healthcare in the U.S. is now at the lowest point in Gallup's trend dating back to 2001. Between 2001 and 2020, majorities ranging from 52 to 62% rated U.S. healthcare quality positively. Now, 54% say it's only fair or poor. That's 38% who say it's fair and 16% that say it's poor. As has been the case throughout the 24-year trend, Americans rate healthcare coverage in the U.S. even more negatively than they rate quality. Just 28% say coverage is excellent or good, 4 points lower than the average since 2001 and well below the 41% high point in 2012. In addition to registering subpar ratings of the quality and coverage of healthcare in the U.S., few Americans, only 19%, say they are satisfied with its cost. An open-ended question measuring Americans' views on the most urgent health problems facing the country finds that two issues relating to healthcare system are the highest: cost at 23% and access at 14%. Americans' largely negative views regarding healthcare coverage and quality in the U.S. likely contribute to the widespread perception that the overall healthcare system has major problems, which 54% of respondents believe, or is in a state of crisis, which 1 in 6 or 16% believe. So you add those up, and that is basically you have 70% of Americans believe that the U.S. healthcare system either has major problems or is in a state of crisis. Not a good review. And the next polling comes, results that may belie some of the divide in America, this from The Hill. Majority of Americans say healthcare is government responsibility. 62% of Americans say it's the federal government's responsibility to ensure everyone has healthcare coverage, a survey from Gallup found. The figure is the highest it's been in more than a decade. It slipped to its low of 42% in 2013 during the difficult rollout of the ACA, commonly known as Obamacare. It was at its highest in 2006, when 69% of Americans believed healthcare should be covered by the government. Gallup noted that as President-elect Trump prepares to take the White House again, public support for the ACA is just as high as it was during his first term. Trump and Republicans attempted to unsuccessfully repeal the ACA in 2017, and he has indicated he is interested in trying again to dismantle the law, but the survey shows doing so could be a difficult task. And next up, in some opinions of the incoming Trump administration, this from Axios, most Americans distrust Trump and RFK Jr. on health. The public trusts Anthony Fauci more than President-elect Trump and his incoming health team as a source of medical information, according to the latest Axios-Ipsos American Health Index. But Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s focus on safe food and nutrition clearly resonates with many Americans, who see chemicals and unsafe additives as a bigger health risk than climate change or infectious diseases. Only about a third think the government puts the public's health and well-being first, or that America is adequately prepared to deal with another pandemic. There is lingering dissatisfaction with health industries. 59% support banning TV pharma ads, and 64% want insurers to cover prescription weight loss drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy, up 3 percentage points when asked the question in August. members of the incoming Trump administration won't be entering office with widespread public trust. 60% or more of respondents say they have at least a fair amount of trust in information from the FDA, CDC, and National Institutes of Health, and 45% report trusting information from Fauci. Fewer say they have the same amount of trust in information on health topics from Trump, 32%, Kennedy, 30%, Elon Musk, 25%, Mehmet Oz, 23%, and others Trump has nominated to lead federal health agencies. Kennedy, Trump's pick for Health and Human Services Secretary, has struck a chord with his focus on food and nutrition. Some of that is linked to concern with obesity, which continues to rank as the top overall health threat, ahead of poor mental health and opioids and fentanyl. But support for his other positions is low. Just over a quarter of the public, at 29%, supports removing fluoride from water supplies. About 1 in 5, that is 18%, back ending vaccine requirements for attending public schools. One quarter, 24%, support firing science staff at the FDA and NIH, and 1 in 5, 19%, would reduce testing requirements before allowing new drugs or therapies to be sold to the public. The survey shows that the public still sees a significant role for government in healthcare. Presented with a choice between Musk's and Kennedy's positions, 60% support increasing food safety inspections to 37% cutting federal spending by $2 trillion. Majorities want to see public health programs strengthened, including 72% for food safety inspections, 71% for the Veterans Health Administration, 64% for Medicare, 57% for the CDC, and 54% for Medicaid. 73% say the Affordable Care Act should be strengthened or left as it is. Okay, well, all of that certainly bodes for a difficult time for the Trump administration making much progress, but the context and recent news that complicates all this, of course, is the assassination of the United Healthcare Insurance Company CEO. And I want to do a couple stories on that and make a little commentary. This first up from the Hill, Ocasio-Cortez says people experience denied claims as, quote, act of violence. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, said denied claims from a health insurance company could be interpreted by people struggling to afford health-related costs as an act of violence against them. All of that pain that people have experienced is being concentrated on this event. It is really important that we take a step back. This is not to comment, and this is not to say that an act of violence is justified. But I think for anyone who is confused or shocked or appalled, they need to understand that people interpret and feel and experience denied claims as an act of violence against them, Ocasio-Cortez told CBS. People go homeless over the financial devastation of a diagnosis that doesn't get addressed or the amount they're going to have to cover with a surprise bill, the congresswoman added. The shooting shines a light on the tensions between Americans and the health insurance industry. Senator Elizabeth Warren also said in a recent interview that the shooting could be a warning, quote, to everyone in the healthcare system, adding that, quote, people can be pushed only so far. Shell casings at the scene had words written on them with a marker, according to the Associated Press, which were said to have included depose, deny, and defend, terms that are often used to describe health insurers' companies' tactics to avoid paying out claims for medical treatment. Those three words are also similar to the title of a 2010 book critical of the industry, Delay, Deny, Defend, Why Insurance Companies Don't Pay Claims and What You Can Do About It. When we kind of talk about how systems are violent in this country in this passive way, our privatized healthcare system is like that for a huge amount of Americans, Ocasio-Cortez said as she shared her own struggle with getting health insurance. And next up, a little more elucidation on the Elizabeth Warren comments. This from the Boston Globe. Senator Elizabeth Warren says CEO's killing should be a warning. Senator Elizabeth Warren said that while violence is never the answer, the outrage directed at health insurers after the fatal shooting of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson should be a warning to the healthcare industry that people can only be pushed so far. The visceral response from people across the country who feel cheated, ripped off, and threatened by the vile practices of their insurance companies should be a warning to everyone in the healthcare system, said Warren, a longtime critic of the U.S. healthcare system. Violence is never the answer, but people can be pushed only so far. This is a warning that if you push people hard enough, they lose faith in the ability of our government to make change, lose faith in the ability of the people who are providing the healthcare to make change, and start to take matters into their own hands in ways that will ultimately be a threat to anyone. Okay, well, next up, and have an opinion piece from The Hill. The pitchforks are here. Populist rage and the rise of moral absolutism. In 2014, billionaire Nick Hanauer warned in Politico that the pitchforks are coming for us plutocrats. He argued that extreme inequality inevitably leads to revolution, comparing it to bankruptcy. It happens slowly, then all at once. A single act of violence, he cautioned, could ignite years of simmering frustration into an inferno of uncontrolled fury. When combined with a generation taught that disagreement itself constitutes harm, that warning seems perilously prophetic in the wake of the United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson's murder. Immediately following his assassination, something disturbing emerged. With breathtaking speed, celebration became the predominant response. Within hours, social media erupted not with horror or condemnation, but with declarations of justice served, some thinly veiled and others brazen in their glee. These weren't just scattered trolls or fringe activists. The approval came from suburban parents, office workers, writers, influencers, teachers, and professors. The very people shaping future generations' understanding of discourse and disagreement. Some of these same voices who argue that challenging their ideas constitutes violence were now celebrating actual violence without hesitation. As Hanauer pointed out, the stratification of wealth and inequality set the stage, and the numbers behind our current populist rage are staggering. The wealthiest 1% now hold more wealth than the bottom 90% combined, while wages for the average worker have stagnated for decades. For millions, the cost of basic necessities, healthcare, housing, and education, has become crippling. But I'll add food to that, too. But equally staggering are developments in our schools and universities, where students whine that challenging their views is a form of harm, that intellectual discomfort is trauma, that disagreement invalidates their personhood. We've seen this pattern evolve through cancel culture, where complex individuals were reduced to their worst moment or most controversial statement, digitally vilified and drawn and quartered. Critics warned that teaching people to respond to disagreement with demands for punishment and banishment rather than engagement would lead to darker places. Many Americans still insist revolutionary unrest could never happen here, perhaps the most dangerous delusion of all. Skeptics often point to 1968 as a modern analog. The assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, the riots at the Democratic Convention, the war protests and the violent police response as evidence that America has weathered worse without collapsing. But that ignores two crucial distinctions. First, 1968 fell during one of the greatest periods of economic expansion in U.S. history. Second, it was an era where political opponents could engage in substantive debate without being branded as existential threats. Back then, young idealistic revolutionaries might have taken to the streets and even turned to violence, but many ultimately receded into conventional society, thanks to a strong middle class and genuinely upward mobility. That economic engine, coupled with a belief in the power of dialogue to effect change, provide an escape valve that simply doesn't exist today. The rise of this moral absolutism, wherein debate is violence and disagreement is erasure, combined with unprecedented economic stratification, creates perfect conditions for actual violence to flourish. When you teach people that words constitute violence while simultaneously stripping away paths to economic dignity, physical violence becomes not just self-defense, but inevitable. When you insist that challenging ideas invalidates personhood while concentrating wealth in fewer and fewer hands, eliminating ideological opponents becomes a moral imperative. The pitchforks aren't just here. They're being forged in our classrooms, sharpened on social media, and wielded by those who have taught us that words are violence and debate is oppression. Is it already too late? Perhaps. But averting the worst requires reclaiming abandoned principles. We must restore not just economic opportunity, but the very possibility of good faith disagreement. We must teach the next generation that challenging ideas isn't violence. It's how societies progress. We must embrace complexity and reject the false comfort of moral absolutes. Economic inequality must be addressed, not as a favor to the poor, but as a necessity for societal stability. The warning signs are flashing red. Whether we heed them will determine not just America's fate, but whether we can ever return to a society capable of solving problems through discourse rather than destruction. So I like the setup in the title about moral absolutism. My own personal opinion, though, is that he really misses the boat here, because he's really talking about the superficial kind of saying that, you know, that words are what people see as violence. I think actually that violence is the foundation, the essence actually of our society existing. And particularly for those of us who live in Rome, in the imperial state, where we benefit from the violence that happens both in this country and around the world. I think that people see that. And I think the fact that people actually, their rage includes the possibility of violence is not a surprise. This is actually what our country is. I actually think it's probably what humanity is. Most people are willing to throw somebody under the bus with lethal force. Now, of course, the civil thing to do it is in a faraway place to people who are different than us, and that we don't have to really pay attention to it. But I think that when, for instance, in this country, which we claim to be a democracy, the will of the people is not actually enacted. Healthcare is the perfect example of this. People have been unhappy with healthcare for decades and decades and decades. But we see that the predatory capitalists have been able to just milk this system and just get more and more money out of it, while the quality and the coverage actually gets thinner and thinner, which people, of course, see, because if it hasn't happened to you personally, it's happened to people around you over the years and years of your life. The point where this opinion writer, I think, has it is that the distinction of earlier times being an economic expansion did mitigate some of that, because people had, quote, prosperity to look forward to, and that took people out of a more revolutionary mode. My revolutionary mode is more with Gandhi's definition of violence. He called world hunger the greatest violence, is that any injustice is a form of inviolence. It takes many forms, and that we need to be nonviolent across the board. As I said earlier, I think that that actually is not the case for our culture. When we say over and over, even the most kind of provocative statements, people will always say, of course, violence is unacceptable. My argument and thesis is that, in fact, if you look at who we are as a nation and as a humanity on this planet, of course, violence is acceptable. If violence wasn't acceptable, we'd be living in a very, very different world. The question is, do we feel personally threatened by that violence or not? And I think when the pitchforks come out for people that are very elite, of course, those are the same people that are running a lot of the opinion pieces and, you know, in the media and government, political leaders, all that kind of thing. Even just well-educated liberals get a little bit scared, because we don't. Who wants to see that kind of disruption and chaos? I, of course, think I'm more like with MLK Jr., that saying that riots are the voice of the unheard. And I think this type of assassination of United Healthcare, or, you know, CEOs for healthcare CEOs, is really just a desperate grasping of trying to come up with some solution when the will of the people is not actually met. And, of course, violence isn't a direct way of dealing with that, but it feels good, apparently, with all the people that it resonates with. And what we need to do is look at what are the layers of injustice that happen, and I believe work with those in a nonviolent manner, but in a more radical way, that where we can each put our skin in the game and not just try to ignore the benefits that we ourselves get from an unjust system. Okay, well, enough of that rant. Let's drill down a little bit to some of the policies and legal framework that undergird such problems. This from the LA Times. The United Healthcare killing won't improve insurance. This could. In the 1990s, California pioneered a patient rights movement that gave those covered by HMOs a right to second opinions, independent medical reviews of coverage denials, and guaranteed coverage of certain commonly denied procedures. Many states adopted California's model, and President Obama's Affordable Care Act took important steps to ensure the uninsured and prevent companies from denying coverage to people who want it. But America's patients never got equitable access to justice when claims are denied. People who buy their own insurance or get it through a government job or program, such as Medicare, have the right to sue for damages if they believe they've been harmed by an unreasonable denial. But most of us get health insurance through our jobs and have no such right to go to court, no matter how outrageous the denial or tragic the consequences. More than 100 million Americans have no legal recourse if a health insurance company messes up our claim. In the 1987 case Pilot Life Insurance Company versus Dedeaux, the Supreme Court ruled that people with employer-provided coverage do not have a right to sue their insurers for damages, but rather only for the value of the denied benefit. If the covered person dies, any suit is rendered moot. Just wait them out. Despite any attempts to change this, despite many attempts to change this, including through Obamacare, the ruling has stood. That's why insurance companies often act as if they have a license to kill. They face scant legal consequences for any harm they cause by delaying or denying payment for needed care. This shouldn't be hard. Congress, whose members do enjoy a right to sue over denials of their own health insurance claims, has many options for limiting the extent of insurers' exposures to lawsuits, such as making them liable only when they show gross indifference to a patient's suffering. Insurance companies pay attention to whether patients can take them to court. At least one company, Aetna, even had a training tape showing how to process claims differently for those with and without a right to sue. If insurance companies have no legal incentive to approve a claim, they will too often deny or delay it. It's time for Congress to restore the possibility of justice for millions and answer the urgent calls for reform. So this is dealing with the 100 million or so Americans that have employer-based coverage. But of course, even those that have appeal processes, how many people actually have the time or money or resources or wherewithal to actually contend with that? And as seen on many regulatory fronts, even if you have the laws and those laws are enforced, in many cases, the actual penalties that businesses have, particularly very profitable businesses like healthcare, can easily write off those legal expenses as a business expense. In fact, that has been explicitly stated recently. I covered this, in the last couple months, basically just bald-faced just saying, we understand that, the government can sue us for doing these things that are illegal, but it's a lot cheaper to do that than to actually follow the law, just continue breaking it and write it off as a business expense. Okay, well, next up, to anchor this in the epidemiology of where we're at with American healthcare, this from The Guardian. Americans spend more time living with diseases than the rest of the world, study shows. The American Medical Association has published its latest findings revealing that Americans live with diseases for an average of 12.4 years. Mental and substance use disorders, as well as musculoskeletal diseases, are main contributors to the years lived with disability in the U.S. Women in the U.S. exhibited a 2.6-year higher so-called health span-lifespan gap, which represents the number of years spent sick, than men, women increasing from 12.2 to 13.7 years, or 32% beyond the global average for women. The latest overall health span-lifespan gap in the U.S. marks an increase from 10.9 years in 2000 to 12.4 years in 2024, which is a 29% higher gap than the global average. Globally, the health span-lifespan gap has widened over the last 20 years, extending to 9.6 years from 8.5 years in 2000, a 13% increase globally. The study added that in line with global trends, the gap in the U.S. coincided with a disproportionate growth in life expectancy versus health-adjusted life expectancy since 2000. In the U.S., life expectancy increased from 79.2 to 80.7 years in women, and from 74.1 to 76.3 years in men, the study revealed. And of course, it's important to note, this is the year 2000. I have a story later, which you reported earlier, where we're actually below where we were, I think, in 1990. I'll get to that. But the basic point being, even if we are living longer, we're often living the majority of that extra time in a disabled state. Okay, well, next up, let's spend a little time revisiting the single largest preventable cause of death in the U.S. and the world, tobacco. This from CNN. In Biden administration's final days, FDA advances proposal to set a nicotine limit on tobacco products. As the Biden administration winds down, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration submitted a proposal that could significantly lower the amount of nicotine in tobacco products and potentially prompt more people to quit smoking. The FDA has been signaling its intentions to limit nicotine levels at least since 2018 during the first Trump administration. In 2022, President Joe Biden's FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf took it a step further and announced that the agency was developing a rule that would require tobacco companies to significantly reduce the amount of nicotine in traditional cigarettes. The next regulatory step, which the FDA took last Tuesday by submitting the proposal to the Office of Management and Budget, would not mean overnight change, but if the government did set a limit on nicotine levels, experts say, it could significantly improve public health. A proposed product standard to establish a maximum nicotine level to reduce the addictiveness of cigarettes and certain combusted tobacco products, when finalized, would be among the most impactful population-level actions in the history of U.S. tobacco product regulation, the FDA said in a statement. The number of people who smoke has been declining for more than a decade, but smoking is still the leading cause of preventable death, disease, and disability in the country, according to the CDC. More than 16 million Americans are living with a smoking-related disease today. As of 2021, over 28 million U.S. adults were considered current smokers. Surveys show that most want to quit, but nicotine is highly addictive, changing the brain in ways that make people want to smoke more. Half of smokers say they've tried to quit in the past year, but fewer than 1 in 10 were successful. Studies show that when the nicotine content of cigarettes is reduced, people smoke less and make more attempts to quit. Cigarettes with lower nicotine levels seem to be effective in alleviating withdrawal, research shows. When the FDA announced its initial plans to reduce nicotine in 2022, it estimated that reducing nicotine levels could keep more than 33 million people from becoming regular smokers, that about 5 million additional smokers would quit within a year, and that 134 million years of life would be gained. In the draft proposal from 2018, which the FDA has since refined, it cited a 2013 survey that found that reducing the total nicotine content of cigarettes to half a milligram per rod would minimize addictiveness. But it also said that questions remain with respect to the precise level of nicotine in cigarettes. The agency proposal was met with high praise. Once finalized, this rule could be a game changer in our nation's effort to eliminate tobacco use, said Harold Wimmer, president and CEO of the American Lung Association. Making tobacco products non-addictive would dramatically reduce the number of young people who become hooked when they are experimenting. To fully address the toll of tobacco on our nation's health and across all communities, it is critical to reduce nicotine's levels to non-addictive levels in all commercial tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. Not all smokers would quit if nicotine levels were limited, experts say, nor would all smoking-related diseases disappear, since tobacco products contain other chemicals that can be harmful for health. There won't be any immediate changes to tobacco products. The Office of Management and Budget's approval process can take months. There will also be a public comment period, and the tobacco industry often sues the government to stop new regulations. It is also unclear what the FDA will do with such a proposal under President-elect Donald Trump. During his first term, the agency signaled that it wanted to limit nicotine, but the tobacco industry donated heavily to Republicans ahead of this year's elections, and Trump's pick for chief of staff worked as a tobacco lobbyist. Right in the White House. Okay, well, next up, let's do a couple more seasonal stories. This from NBC News. Flu shots among kids fall, hitting their lowest point in years. Even though a record number of kids died from the flu last year, the percentage of kids getting flu shots continues to plummet. The CDC reported that as of November 30th, just over a third of U.S. kids, that's 37%, had gotten flu shots, down from 43% at the same time last year. Just over half the kids, 55%, got the flu shot during the 2023-2024 season, the lowest rate in 12 years, said Alicia Budd, head of the CDC's Domestic Influenza Surveillance Team. Flu coverage has been slowly increasing before COVID hit, Budd said. Flu vaccination levels have not rebounded to pre-pandemic levels. A preliminary report released in October suggested the flu shot's effectiveness at keeping kids age 5 and younger out of the hospital may be on the lower end, just 39%. Last year's shot was estimated to be up to 61% effective at preventing hospitalization in kids. Dr. Michelle Taylor, a pediatrician who is the health officer of the Shelby County Health Department in Memphis, Tennessee, said the flu vaccine is safe and worthwhile, even if it's not perfect. Even if you're exposed and you are positive for flu, that shot gives the best chance of having a much easier course of illness than if you had not been vaccinated at all. Who needs a flu shot this year? The CDC recommends an annual flu shot for everyone 6 months and older. For most, that's a single shot. Kids who've had only one shot may need 2-4 weeks apart to be considered fully vaccinated. We know that more than 80% of the reported influenza-associated pediatric deaths last season occurred in children who were eligible for a flu vaccine but weren't fully vaccinated, Bud said. It's another reminder of how important vaccination is. And as we're seeing our first bitter cold weather of the season here, remind you that even in California, it's cold. This from Kaiser Family Health News. More Californians are freezing to death. Experts point to more older, homeless people. According to the California Department of Healthcare Access Information, homeless people account for 18% of hospitalizations and emergency room visits related to hypothermia from 2019 to 2023. Homeless Californians represent nearly 0.5% of the state's population, suggesting they're about 40 times as likely as others to end up in the hospital for hypothermia. Federal data shows more than 2/3 of the state's 181,000 homeless people are unsheltered, and among those dying from hypothermia, one group has been particularly hard hit. Older adults are most susceptible to hypothermia, with people 55 and older accounting for more than three-quarters of hypothermia deaths in California from 2021 to 2023, CDC data shows. There is a massive increase in the aging homeless population, said Margot Cusho, director of the University of California, San Francisco Homelessness and Housing Initiative. She said the proportion of single homeless adult Californians who are 50 or older has increased from 11% in 1990 to nearly 50%. And as the number of deaths from exposure to cold has risen in the state, so has the number of deaths from exposure to heat in the summer. A changing climate, more temperature extremes, more soaking rains, people are older and thus unable to even tolerate it, so they get much sicker faster, Cushel said. The trend could worsen. The proportion of the homeless population 65 or older is projected to triple in the United States between 2017 and 2030, according to UCSF researchers. California's hypothermia death rate is highest in its rural, mountainous, northern counties, but most deaths are occurring in urban centers. Bob Erlenbush, an advocate at the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness, said many homeless people are cold because local authorities have confiscated items including blankets, sleeping bags, and tents during sweeps. They're not supposed to take people's stuff, he said. They're supposed to tag it and store it, but that doesn't happen. Cushel said the long-term solution to the rise in hypothermia deaths is to prevent people from falling into homelessness and get those who are already homeless into housing. In the meantime, she said, cities need to open more warming centers and cooling centers in the summer and make sure they are accessible. Amen to that. And next up, another story on a vulnerable population. This is from Associated Press. Federal officials say South Carolina mental illness group homes leave little hope of independence. The federal government has sued South Carolina, saying the state has not done enough to make sure people with serious mental illnesses are taken out of group homes and helped to get back into the community where they can work and lead independent lives. The lawsuit said the state violates the Americans with Disabilities Act by opting, through money and policy decisions, to leave people with mental illnesses in group homes where they can't choose what to eat, pick their own roommate, find a way to work at a job, or go to church and other activities. Federal officials suggested spending more money and making sure the state's Medicaid program makes adequate payments for programs called assertive community treatments. Under the programs, teams visit people with serious mental illnesses in their home. There is at least one psychiatrist, two psychiatric nurses, specialists in employment, and substance abuse, and other professionals. Researchers found that teams often can head off a mental health crisis. They can also provide crisis teams that can respond quickly to prevent bigger issues, from police involvement to psychiatric hospital stays, the Justice Department investigation found. There are only four teams in South Carolina, in Columbus, Greenville, and Dillon, and they don't provide statewide coverage. They also have low staffing. Residents of the group home often only get to leave for a monthly outing to Walmart or Dollar General. They have no way of working because they can't get transportation to a job. Sometimes the home is fenced in with locked doors and security cameras. There's no vision of ever getting out. There's no vision of having a real life. There's no vision of anything. They just feel stuck. That's almost like hospitals used to be 150 years ago, a state employee who regularly visits one home told investigators. So I think this story is particularly interesting in the context of the Department of Health and Human Services nominee, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's one of his big ideas is doing wellness centers, hundreds of these around the nation for people to go to get better. Well, of course, I think in a Republican administration that is more concerned, is very little concerned with starting new big programs. And if you look at the reality of, say, South Carolina, a red state that doesn't take care of the seriously mentally ill, for the most basic things of having autonomy in life, I'm very skeptical of the fact they're going to be able politically to make much of that type of thing ever happen. So may we be able to put the resources and policies in place that will allow people with serious disabilities, in this case mental illnesses, to live a life that is full of autonomy and opportunity. In fact, it costs less to actually prevent these big problems rather than warehousing people. Okay, well, next up, let's do an interesting story that actually forges a connection between environmental health and mental health. This from Science Daily. 20th century lead exposure damaged American mental health. Exposure to car exhaust from leaded gasoline during childhood altered the balance of mental health in the U.S. population, making generations of Americans more depressed, anxious, and inattentive or hyperactive, according to researchers. They estimated that 151 million cases of psychiatric disorder over the past 75 years have resulted from American children's exposure to lead. Lead is neurotoxic and can erode brain cells and alter brain function after it enters the body. As such, there is no safe level of exposure at any point in life, health experts say. Young children are especially vulnerable to lead's ability to impair brain development and alter brain health. Unfortunately, no matter what age, our brains are ill-equipped for keeping lead toxicity at bay. Because water systems in older American cities still contain lead pipes, the EPA issued regulations in October that gave cities 10 years to identify and replace lead plumbing and $2.6 billion to get it done. Earlier this year, the EPA also lowered the level of lead in soil that it considers to be potentially hazardous, resulting in an estimated 1 in 4 U.S. households having soil that may require cleanup. Humans are not adapted to be exposed to lead at the levels we've been exposed to over the past century. We have very few effective measures for dealing with lead once it is in the body, and many of us have been exposed to levels 1,000 to 10,000 times more than what is natural. Over the past century, lead has been used in paint, pipes, solder, and most disastrously, automotive fuel, plain fuel as well. Numerous studies have linked lead exposure to neurodevelopmental and mental health problems, particularly conduct disorder, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, and depression. But until now, it has not been clear how widespread lead-linked mental illness symptoms would have been. Leaded gasoline consumption rose rapidly in the early 60s and peaked in the 1970s. Essentially, everyone born during those two decades were nearly certain to have been exposed to pernicious levels of lead from car exhaust. The generation with the greatest lead exposures, Generation X, 1965 to 1980, would have seen the greatest mental health losses. Of course, there is some good news within this bad news. I've reported a lot on how it seems each ensuing generation is actually less healthy, but this goes back to those kids that were born in the 60s and 70s exposed to so much lead from automotive exhaust, from leaded gasoline, but that would actually be less now, given the fact that lead's been taken out, etc. We're still dealing with lead problems, but the huge problem of leaded gasoline, except like some small planes and such, has been eliminated. Now we just have to get lead out of other places and do remediation. A lot of work, but this is where current generations are actually better off than generations of yore. Okay, well, next up, another environmental story. This one, the Environmental Health Network. Formaldehyde exposure lurks in homes, cars, and everyday products. Most people unknowingly breathe dangerous levels of formaldehyde, a toxic chemical found in furniture, cars, and household items that pose serious health risks. Tests conducted in furniture stores, salons, homes, and cars revealed formaldehyde levels exceeding the EPA's safe thresholds, sometimes by over 10 times. Formaldehyde, released from items like gas stoves, adhesives, and furniture, causes respiratory issues, asthma, and cancer, particularly myeloid leukemia. Despite regulations, exposures remain high, disproportionately affecting lower-income populations who lack resources to minimize their risk. Key quote from this article, "It is holding together our built environment and also chemically corroding us at the same time. It's part of our fundamental paradox of the world that we've built. Where this chemical is holding together our homes, we have built our society around it," said Nicholas Shapiro, a researcher at UCLA. Why this matters? Formaldehyde exposure is widespread and largely unavoidable due to its use in common products. Long-term exposure increases the risk of respiratory problems and cancer, making indoor air quality a significant public health concern. Reducing the risk requires stronger regulations and public awareness. You have been informed. And in more environmental news, this from The Hill, EPA proposes raising atrazine safety thresholds, sparking criticism. The Biden administration is proposing to raise a key threshold determining how much of a pesticide that's commonly used in the agriculture industry the EPA finds concerning in the environment, spurring ire from some environmental advocates. The agency currently considers an average of just 3.4 micrograms per liter of the pesticide atrazine to be an acceptable level, but a proposal released last week raised the level up to 9.7 micrograms, saying nearly three times as much of the substance is okay to be present in the environment. Lori Ann Bird, Environmental Health Program Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, slammed the proposal. Atrazine is so toxic, even in microscopic amounts, and so extremely persistent that effective mitigation is just impossible. But the EPA keeps bending over backwards to accommodate growers who insist on drenching our nation's food, fiber, and fuel with atrazine at the expense of public health and the environment. Atrazine is used on many U.S. crops, including corn and sugarcane. It has been banned in the European Union and several other countries and has been found to disrupt the endocrine system. The Biden administration's move is just a proposal. It's unclear what will happen to atrazine under the incoming Trump administration. In 2020, the prior Trump administration raised the safety threshold even higher to 15 micrograms per liter. Well, there's the answer to your question. They'll probably make it even worse. However, the substance has also come under attack from right-wing figures like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., whom President-elect Trump nominated to lead to the Department of Health and Human Services. Kennedy has suggested that atrazine can cause, quote, sexual changes in children. Experts told CNN that this is not true. So, well, RFK Jr., maybe for the wrong reasons, you can do the right thing and push back against raising atrazine levels in our food, fiber, and fuel, the environment. Okay, well, let's close regular reporting with a couple nutrition stories. This is from Medical Express. Unhealthy ultra-processed foods, now half of calories Americans eat at home. Unhealthy ultra-processed foods have wormed their way into American kitchens, likely harming people's health for decades, a new study published in the Journal of Nutrition warns. More than half of the calories adults eat at home now come from ultra-processed foods, which contain high levels of sugar, salt, fat, and other additives, and have been linked to heart disease, obesity, and type 2 diabetes. Ultra-processed foods encompass many more products than just junk food or fast food, including most of the foods in the grocery store. The proliferation and ubiquity of ultra-processed foods on grocery store shelves is changing what we are eating when we make meals at home. Overall, ultra-processed foods comprise more than half of all calories consumed at home, rising from 51% in 2003 to 54% at 2018. So actually, this has been around for a long time. It only modestly went up over those 15 years. But here's the kicker. Worse, the proportion of total calories from healthy, minimally processed foods fell during the study period from 33% in 2003 to 29% in 2018. So we're also seeing a drop in those minimally processed foods that you might standardly assume are the raw ingredients in home-cooked meals. Ultra-processed foods tend to be tempting even for people who like to cook. They are easier and faster to prepare, and they often cost less and are more shelf-stable than scratch ingredients. We need strategies to help people choose less processed foods and avoid unhealthy ultra-processed foods for foods purchased both at home and away from home consumption. Additionally, strong nutrition labels warning of high ultra-processed food content may be warranted. And next, from Associated Press, more beans and less red meat. Nutrition experts weigh in on the U.S. dietary guidelines. Americans should eat more beans, peas, and lentils and cut back on red and processed meats and starchy vegetables, all while continuing to limit added sugars, sodium, and saturated fat. That's the advice by a panel of nutrition experts charged with counseling the U.S. government about the 2025 edition of the dietary guidelines that will form the cornerstone of federal food programs and policy. But the 20-member panel didn't weigh in on the growing role of ultra-processed foods that have been linked to health problems, saying there's not enough evidence to tell people to avoid them. And the group steered clear of updating controversial guidance on alcohol consumption, leaving that analysis by two outside reports expected to be released soon. By the way, my personal opinion, and I've reported a lot on both of these issues, it's been well established that ultra-processed foods are not good for you, and they're actually alcohol is not good for you either, basically at any level from a nutritional health point of view. This looks like every other set of dietary guidelines since 1980. Eat your veggies and reduce consumption of foods high in salt, sugar, and saturated fat. This particular statement says nothing about balancing calories when overconsumption of calories, especially from ultra-processed foods, is the biggest challenge to the health of Americans. Do Americans follow dietary guidelines? The advisory panel acknowledged that the diets of most Americans don't meet the current guidelines. More than half of all U.S. adults have one or more diet-related chronic health conditions, and 18 million U.S. households have insecure sources of food. Nutrition-related chronic health conditions and their precursors continue to threaten health throughout the lifespan, the report concludes, which does not bode well for the future of health in the United States. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode and previous episodes. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 29 bonus articles this week. Number one, bird flu suspected in cats that drink raw milk as virus kills animals at Arizona Zoo. So bird flu has been particularly dangerous for cats, has a high mortality rate, and of course they're drinking raw milk both on farms and at the zoo has led to flu cases in cats, yet another reservoir in animals for the mixing of bird flu into potentially human flu. Bonus article 2, horses have been infected with bird flu in Asia, and that infections have been occurring unnoticed. Again, over 50 mammalian species have been infected with the so-called bird flu. It's becoming a misnomer to call it bird flu because it's running across species. Sort of kind of crazy in the last year, at least, that we've been able to track. Bonus article 3, melting Arctic permafrost could unleash dangerous new pathogens. I reported on this before. A lot of times this has been around about like zombie viruses, so-called zombie viruses being released, pathogens that we haven't been exposed to in a long time that have been shown to be able to survive literally thousands of years frozen. But this is an interesting one because we're actually creating a new biome, which is the melting Arctic permafrost. It creates this kind of slurry that is a new place for microbial species to grow and develop, and this could potentially include pathogens, new pathogens. Bonus article 4. Scientists estimate around 1 in 5 of the world under 50 is living with genital herpes, so very common STD present in the world. Bonus article 5. U.S. health panel adds home self-testing option for cervical cancer screening. So, of course, cervical cancer is almost exclusively caused by HPV, which there is a vaccine for. But the FDA recently approved a very effective self-testing option, which can be used at home. And this health panel is recommending that that can be used as an option. Bonus article 6. Prevention and screening outpace treatment advances for averting death from 5 major cancer types. This is just a big plug for the effectiveness of public health, that in fact, we focus a lot on new fancy cancer treatments, but prevention and screening avert more deaths than improvements in cancer treatment. Of course, a lot of the prevention of this, most of this actually for these 5 major types, is affecting the number one cause of death, which is lung cancer, quitting smoking. If you need help doing that, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Bonus article 7, you may be eating pre-digested food, which is another term for ultra-processed food. And here's why. This is a good article that really gets in depth about why, one of the reasons why ultra-processed food is so dangerous. It basically bypasses our digestive system and kind of fools our brain into thinking that it's not actually eating. I have this effect. One of the few things that I'm addicted to with food that I have a hard time controlling is chips. I can eat a whole bag of chips. I joke that they come in one serving because when I start eating, I don't even notice that I'm actually being filled up. This is the beauty of food chemistry and the evil of predatory capitalism preying on our health. Bonus article 9, how the FDA allows companies to add secret ingredients to food. Basically, the Clinton administration years ago changed the generally recognized as safe laws, where there was a lot of petitions to have studies done about things that were grandfathered in, food ingredients. Now, basically, companies really do their own research, and they don't even have to reveal that research. They just, if they consider it in-house for it to be safe, they just add it. So it's really, the self-regulation is not a good setup for keeping companies honest and our health protected. Bonus article 10, federal courts order USDA to strengthen oversight of genetically engineered crops. So this is a win in the federal courts saying that the GMO oversight was actually too weak and needs to be strengthened. Bonus article 11, Ghost Network's class action lawsuit may signal trouble for insurers. So here's some more legal pushback. Suing healthcare insurance companies for these ghost networks, which are basically these networks of providers that actually aren't there. I've had personal experience with this. Many people have. You look for the provider and they say they're either not there, they retired, they don't accept new patients, and you get the runaround. So basically what's listed on paper has very little correlation with reality. Bonus article 12. Judges topple gun restrictions as courts chart an uncertain path forward. So this is since the big New York case that really got rid of some common sense gun protections. The uncertain path forward is that the Supreme Court has not been really clear in what exactly the boundaries would be of gun rights and common sense restrictions that would be constitutional, but it looks like it'll be a net negative for the public health. More suicides, more murders. Bonus article 13. U.S. Supreme Court leans towards limiting environmental impact reviews. And this is somehow based on the fact that these that they're hard to do, that environmental impact reviews by their very nature are often over a long period of time and often a large geographic area. And that just seems impractical to actually take care of our environment, so says this U.S. Supreme Court. Bonus Article 14, toxic forever chemicals taint rural California drinking water far from known sources. This is part of the problem, is that in this instance, these collection of forever chemicals, they travel through air, soil, water, rain. So it isn't just being next to a toxic pollutant source, some factory that's doing manufacturing of these chemicals or using these chemicals. Bonus Article 15, I used to do health insurance company PR. Here's what I think the backlash is missing. Wall Street's role in the broken system. So this is a whistleblower, an ex-PR person from the health insurance field. And basically he's saying that capitalism was what's ruining our healthcare system. Yes, I've been saying it for a long time. Bonus Article 16. United Health is strategically limiting access to critical treatment for kids with autism. So this is a specific deep dive by ProPublica about how they have secret documents to limit expensive but gold standard treatments for kids with autism because it saves them money and they think they can get away with it. Bonus Article 17, nine states have trigger laws poised to end coverage for millions if Trump cuts Medicaid funding. So this is kind of interesting. Most of these are red states, but includes Illinois and I think an East Coast blue state. So this is something that if they Trump has said that he doesn't want to cut Medicare or Social Security, but he's left Medicaid on the table there. And basically, with a 90% federal portion of Medicaid funding that the feds give to the states to do Medicaid, if you reduce this, a lot of these trigger laws would just basically end Medicaid or have draconian cuts implemented automatically. Bonus Article 18, will anger at health insurers spur action? Democrats are pessimistic. Well, they've been around this block before, and with an incoming Trump administration who doesn't even barely have concepts of a plan other than deregulation and tax cuts, and the fact that people were even surprised at the anger of this assassination of a healthcare executive probably doesn't bode well for a lot of change coming up. Keep the fight going, people. Bonus Article 19. Trump has flip-flopped on abortion policy. His appointees may offer clues to what happens next. So this is a good longer read to get the nuances of that. He's put a lot of hardcore, hardline anti-abortion folks in, but there is definitely a mixed bag. 20, with a focus on food, RFK Jr. can actually make America healthier. So this is actually from somebody who's the former founder and founding director of the Center for Science and the Public Industry, which did mostly food kind of advocacy action, nutrition stuff. Been around for a long time. So I think on the subject of food, if there's a kept a focus and there's some effective focus on it, it could actually make America healthier. I would say as a whole, I have little optimism that RFK Jr. as a net result will actually make America healthier. Partly because he's in a Republican administration that's more concerned with deregulation than health. Bonus Article 21. The trouble with Trump's pick to run the FDA. Being a contrarian is not the same as empirical skepticism. So it seems that that's politically popular to be a contrarian, but of course you can be contrarian without being particularly scientific. Empirical skepticism is a good thing. We should have good, solid evidence for what our claims are. But this Trump pick, this Dr. McCarrey, he's a contrarian in many things, but the things that he has a personal affinity towards often don't meet the standards that he's applying to other areas. So it comes down to like personal preference. Bonus Article 22. America stopped cooking with tallow for a reason. Speaking of contrarianism, you don't want to be cooking with lard. I won't even say any more on that as a public health nutritionist. Bonus Article 23. Ohio Senate passes measures forcing hospitals to administer ivermectin and other patient-requested treatments. So this wasn't just a crazy thing that people did out of hands. There were actually studies to show that ivermectin did not help with, for instance, with COVID and other things. But this Ohio law shows that it is more about this kind of contrarian, own the libs, kind of a weird anti-professional, anti-science approach. Bonus Article 24, brain rot becomes word of the year. Brain rot is basically from viewing a lot of low quality content on the web and in our lives. Of course, you can't avoid brain rot. You can do bonus article 25. Too much teeth whitening can cause damage. Here's what to know. So you may not be able to fend off brain rot, but you can certainly whiten your teeth. But of course, that relative vanity project can have some health risks, and this article will let you know what those are. Bonus article 26. Drowning deaths decline globally, with the most vulnerable remain at risk. Yes. This is another public health win that we've learned over the years how to prevent drowning deaths, particularly from the youngest kids. But this has not been implemented very evenly across the world. So there's a lot of very vulnerable people still at risk. Bonus article 27. Activists worry that Trump will bulldoze trans rights. Here's what they're preparing. Of course, trans folks are probably the most targeted vulnerable population in America right now, having been politicized so much and demonized. But to see how they're preparing to fend that off, read this article. Bonus article 28. AI thought knee x-ray showed if you drink beer. They don't. This is a good little article that kind of summarizes why AI sometimes appears to be smarter than it is, but it lacks common sense. Sometimes what they call hallucinations. Bonus article 29. Hope can be more powerful than mindfulness. In difficult times, a forward-looking mindset may be especially helpful. Keep hopeful, my friends. You can view these and the other articles by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And I have an epic announcement. This is the last show I'll be producing with contemporary news coverage. I'll do a couple shorter greatest hit shows by the end of the year. There have been some shifts at WAKT and some shifts in my life. The short story is I'll have more room in my life to write poetry and more space to order my life so I can do more serious direct actions to defend peace and justice in a Trumpian era. I hope to see you out there smashing capitalism, ending militarism, and bringing down racism and patriarchy. In regards to the guarantee I've given about listening to my show for a year and knowing more about public health than 99% of the population, if cutting short the show has caused you any problem, you can certainly submit an application for quadruple your money back, and I'd be happy to honor that. I will have one bonus last current news story that I can't just miss that I'll slip into the greatest hit show next week on Christmas Eve or the day after Christmas, depending which episode you're listening to. Thanks so much for listening to this show, and over time, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some